As Iyanla Van Zandt once said, it's important that we share our experiences with other people. Your story will heal you, and your story will heal somebody else. At Project Sleep, we believe that your stories matter, which is why we train people with sleep disorders on how to share their stories through our Rising Voices program. This Rising Voices podcast series features a variety of firsthand stories from people living with sleep disorders around the world. Each person's story offers unique and important insights.
Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. Hello, everybody. We have a very special guest with us tonight, Victoria. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm so glad to be here.
We're so happy to have you. So tonight we have Victoria. She is a homeschooling mother of two, educational diagnostician, and a major horse enthusiast. She was diagnosed with narcolepsy with cataplexy at 26 years old and now hopes to raise awareness of this condition. As a speaker with Project Sleep's Rising Voices program, Victoria will share her experiences finding her diagnosis and living with narcolepsy. Through her story, she hopes to emphasize that feeling understood and accepted is important, even when you don't understand and accept yourself. Please take it away, Victoria.
Thank you so much, Julie. I am so, so excited to be here with everybody today. Just to get started with a little bit about me. Growing up, I was the youngest and definitely the nerdiest of five. To give you a little insight on my nerdiness, all of my siblings attended our regular public high school within our area. Me, when I was getting to the decision about junior high and high school, I decided to go to a magnet school within our area that requires an application and teacher recommendations and things like that. So the day that I was able to get the application, it was all filled out. All of my teacher recommendations, my transcripts, everything was ready to go because this was the school that I wanted to go to so bad. I got home and gave it to my mom and said, "All right, I'm going. I need you to sign." And at that point, she was a little nervous. This is a school that it was going to take an hour bus ride every morning and every afternoon to get there. We hadn't had anybody in our family go there. We did know really good things about the school, but she couldn't tell me no. Like, I was the kind of kid that had my nose in a book all the time. She knew that this was the perfect fit. There was no athletics at this school at the time. And I was not an athletic person at all. So this was good. They had UIL that I participated in and all of that fun stuff. So as it was a magnet charter school, it's a little bit more rigorous. And I was still really just going through every day what I thought everybody else was doing. But then I ended up graduating this high school in 3 years. And I ended up graduating number 5 in my class. So just really, I guess, goes to show how much I really did love learning and what I was doing. And I also graduated with about 32 college credit hours. So when I went into the university, I was well on my way to my degree. And then moving on to the university, I went to school for rehab services with a concentration in deaf studies. The fall semester of my second year, I had my daughter. So I took that entire semester off. And then my last semester before graduating, I had my son, but I knew it was my last semester, so I didn't take it off. And in total, I graduated still in 3 years from college. So I graduated at age 20. And then that summer, I went on to get my teaching certification, and I started teaching that August as a teacher for the deaf and hard of hearing in our area. It's a program that I love. The deaf community is near and dear to my heart. I connected with a lot of families and students who had a lot of hardships at home, just that came naturally, I guess, from being deaf in a hearing family and things like that. That first year of teaching, I had also gotten married. So, I mean, well on my way with a family, two little ones, and a full-time job as a teacher for the deaf and hard of hearing. Okay, and then as I was teaching, and then I was about 23, I had just finished my master's program in special education with a deaf ed concentration, and some just weird things started happening that I really wasn't understanding. So at this point, I was teaching for the deaf and hard of hearing all levels of math. So from basic math to pre-cal, just that was my day-to-day. And math was an area that I knew well. And then I got to helping a student one day, and we were going through some equations, and I hit 2 plus 3, right? And I did this, like 2 plus 3, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like several times before I could get that, okay, Victoria, 2 plus 3 is 5. Like, that's a no-brainer. That's mental math that should be done, has been done for years. My student kind of looked at me funny because I was waiting, it took me a little bit longer to get through that with him, but just something I didn't verbalize and something I didn't dare verbalize at the time. And those things were kind of happening just more and more frequent. I didn't know if it was, I was super tired a lot, but I was also teaching full time with two babies at home. I had just finished my master's program. It was a lot going on all the time. So it was natural that I was that tired. I didn't know. Also about that time, like I said earlier, I love to read. It was just something that I did all the time. And I was no longer able to read as much as I would before. Like, I would get through maybe 2 pages. And then if I went any further, I wasn't going to remember anyway. So it just was becoming more and more difficult. And then coupled with that, I was reading some things a little funny. So for instance, one day that I was reading, I got to this word most of you can read, and it is very obviously garage. But as I was reading it, it was gay rage, it was garage, it was everything but garage for a few times reading it until I finally realized, like, duh, that's garage. So to me, it was, how was I, this person who had just finished her master's degree, that I felt very on top of my education, no longer able to doing very basic things. So I was nervous, but I didn't say anything because I couldn't admit it to everybody. On a funnier note, a different symptom that came to play was one day in my house, this was a couple of years later, I was probably about 25, and we were in my kitchen at home playing Cards Against Humanity. If you've never played Cards Against Humanity, it's definitely that. Every phrase and saying in there is everything wrong that could possibly be said. And it's really fun. It's like an apples to apples. The black card gets read out as a sentence starter, and then everybody else has to finish it, right? Playing it with my friends is fun. Playing it with my siblings even was fun. But this particular day, we were playing with my parents and my grandma. We all got really brave, I guess. But it was a fun night regardless. So my grandma was about 80 years old at the time. She has Alzheimer's. My mom said, there's no possible way that your grandma is going to understand this. But we just wanted to include her. So she was sitting there playing. The card that got picked and was read was, here's the church, here's the steeple, open the doors and see the... So everybody had to fill it out. I put my card down, I walked to go get another drink, and everybody else was figuring out their cards. And my grandma throws down a card and says, 99 virgins. And like... so proud. And at that moment, everybody just started laughing. Like, obviously she really understood what was going on, but the fact that that was the card she pulled just had everybody laughing, hysterically laughing. And I was behind the counter with my drink at that point. My knees kind of buckled. They kind of gave out a little, and I had to catch myself on the counter. So that drink I had was everywhere. Everybody kind of looked at me at that point, like, what happened to that girl? But didn't really go, the situation at hand was way funnier. So while I thought it was weird, it just wasn't so bad. Like, I just went about, cleaned up, and carried on. Definitely a funny experience and memory. Little things like that started getting were becoming more prevalent in my life. Some were just minor, some were really funny like that. But this particular day, I had moved from teaching in McAllen, which is about 30, 45 minutes away from where I am with the School for the Deaf, to a school in my little town because my daughter started kinder. So it was easier for our family this way. And she started to ask me, "Mom, where are we going?" I thought we were going to school because I was making every wrong turn that morning. I could see the school. It was the same campus I went to for kindergarten. All my life has been in there. I just couldn't get there. And so my answer to her, trying to hold back tears, was, "I know we are going to school. We're just taking a different way to school." And then almost in that instant, I just turned on the right road. We saw the school and she yelled from the back, "Oh, Mom, there's my school." And I dropped her off. You know, everything seemed normal for her. And then I carried on to my school, kind of worried. But I knew how to get to my school that morning. So I just carried on driving and I got there. As I was walking in the doors, one of the ladies from our custodial staff asked me, like, I guess she could see it on my face. So she said, "Mija, ¿estás bien? Like, so are you okay?" And I just couldn't hold it together at that point. I started crying. She called my boss, the principal at my campus. He was a good friend of my dad's. Again, we live in a really small town, so everybody kind of knows each other. He had me go and sit in his office in all of my years as a student and a teacher. This was probably the one time I was nervously sitting in the principal's office, like the sixth graders that I was teaching at the time. But my principal was really concerned. He said, "We're going to cover your classes for today and as many days as we need to, really, until, you know, you figure out what's going on." And so I just continued to wait for my parents, knew that things were going to be okay. And then they took me to the ER because something was terribly wrong to them and to me. And I was thankful that this was, you know, not the situation that I wanted, but that we were going to get somewhere. So my mom went with me to the ER, into the room. My dad never left the ER waiting room. My husband at the time didn't come, but things were, you know, well on their way. They could only run some small tests there. So I had a CT scan that ended up checking out okay. But in talking to me and all of the symptoms that I was going through, they referred to a neurologist that I definitely needed to figure out something. So from that day, I mean, we just went home and my mom kind of consoled me through the day. She helped me pick up my daughter, you know, things like that. But then we started seeing where we could go to get something figured out. So we went to a neurologist, just seeing all of the symptoms that I was going through and what she thought. She also, ordered more testing, so CT scans, MRIs, things that, there was something maybe minor that could be happening, but nothing that was alarming. But the symptoms that she was seeing were, I guess, consistent with a condition called idiopathic intracranial hypertension. So basically your brain thinks you have a brain tumor, but you don't. So you have all of these symptoms, and all of these symptoms that I seemed to be having prior kind of checked out for her. So then we ran some spinal taps and things like that. It was an iffy kind of situation. So I went to an ophthalmologist also to check my eyes because that had stuff to, it would have been related. I went to an ENT because at that time I also seemed to be getting headaches at certain times and we couldn't really figure them out. But none of that really gave me solid answers until I think finally she said, "You need to see a sleep doctor because I seem to be sleeping through a lot of stuff." And whether it was because I was having a headache or because I couldn't remember certain things or I was frustrated with my reading inability at that time, I was just sleeping a lot. And so I did go see a sleep doctor. He said to him, it wasn't normal that I was sleeping through so many different things, like as a coping mechanism, but he did want to run a sleep study, an overnight sleep study. And then I did a daytime sleep study, and it took what seemed like years, was now looking back about a year and a half total. And after those sleep studies, he did diagnose me with narcolepsy with cataplexy. So that's great. I've heard of narcolepsy, but didn't really know much past that. I knew the life that I was currently living, but I didn't know what really it meant. So at that point, he did explain to me that narcolepsy is a chronic neurological disorder that impairs the brain's ability to regulate the sleep-wake cycle. It affects 1 in 2,000 people, so about 200,000 Americans and 3 million people worldwide. So now what? It was just something that, okay, now we have to find what our next steps are. So you did hear some of my symptoms. Symptoms do vary by person, and they can include some of these things. So excessive daytime sleepiness are periods of extreme sleepiness during the day that feel comparable to how someone without narcolepsy would feel after staying awake for about 48 to 72 hours. My kids will tell you that this is their mom for sure. They want to watch movies, and that's great. But if I'm not snacking, I'm definitely going to go to sleep. If I'm at my mom's, I'm going to take a nap. It's just part of my day. And then looking back at when I was misreading words and that wasn't really comprehending, and then I wasn't even able to get much further than 2 pages in a book, those were definitely episodes of excessive daytime sleepiness that I just didn't realize weren't just part of my normal life at the time. And then there's cataplexy. So cataplexy is a striking sudden episodes of muscle weakness that are usually triggered by strong emotions, such as laughter, exhilaration, surprise, or anger. The severity may vary from a slackening of the jaw or buckling of the knees to completely falling down. The duration of these things may happen for a few seconds to several minutes, and the person does remain fully conscious, even if they are unable to speak during the actual episode. So that time playing Cards Against Humanity, everybody was laughing and my knees buckled, I dropped things. That was an episode of cataplexy, I would later realize. There are hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, which are visual, auditory, or tactile hallucinations upon falling asleep or waking up. These can often be very frightening and confusing. There's also sleep paralysis, which is the inability to move for a few seconds or minutes upon falling asleep or waking up. It's often accompanied by hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations. It's important to know that people without narcolepsy can experience these hallucinations and sleep paralysis. In fact, about 1/3 of all people experience these at some point in their life. This is usually during periods of high stress or poor sleep. For people with narcolepsy, though, these are much more frequent and consistent over time. So about 25, when all of these other symptoms were happening, I woke up one night to see a man standing in the shadow of my restroom door. And it just, my heart was racing. I was freaking out, but I got up. I just wanted him to go away. I closed the door. And then I turned to go back to my bed, and that same man was standing in the shadows of my closet door. And I ran there to close that door too. And then I remember running and jumping in my bed and pulling these covers over my head, heart racing and just willing him to go away. And then all of a sudden I heard some like laughter, like kind of making fun of me laughter outside of my window. And I kind of like creeped out of the covers, and I did see this man standing in the shadows, like outside my window. It took me a few minutes before, maybe a few minutes, I don't know, but to really realize that there's no possible way that a man could be in my house, at my closet, or at my restroom, and then my closet, and outside, all within a matter of seconds. So that realization, I was able to will him away. I no longer saw him. I didn't hear him, but I was still super, super scared. And all I wanted to do was go back to sleep and forget that that had happened. To this day, if my doors are not closed when I go to sleep, that man is probably going to appear in my shadows. So then there is also some disrupted nighttime sleep. And unlike public perception, people with narcolepsy do not sleep all the time. The timing of sleepiness is off with narcolepsy. So one may fight sleepiness during the day and then really struggle to stay asleep at night. Very, very common. And then brain fog is cognitively experienced as slower thinking or a lack of concentration and forgetfulness and or confusion. These symptoms affect your thinking processes, understanding, judgment, and even memory. So going back to like helping my student in the math class, that 2 + 3 that I wasn't even able to compute at the time was definitely severe brain fog, as I was really tired teaching and raising kids. And, you know, just I think it made it that much worse at the time. So then there are two types of narcolepsy. There's narcolepsy with cataplexy and narcolepsy without cataplexy. Recent research suggests that narcolepsy with cataplexy is caused by a lack of hypocretin, which is a key neurotransmitter, helps sustain alertness and regulate the sleep-wake cycle. Less is known about narcolepsy without cataplexy. Again, my diagnosis is narcolepsy with cataplexy. So then diagnosis, and you heard that I did go through this, it typically does include a 24-hour sleep study that includes a nighttime portion, the polysomnography, and a daytime nap portion, which is a multiple sleep latency test, or an MSLT, what we call, and this records the brain waves. The diagnosis is mainly based on how quickly and frequently one goes into rapid eye movement, or REM sleep, which is also known as the dream sleep stage during these tests. So that's what they're looking for. I did go through these. So this is a common question, I think. So I had this diagnosis, then what was I going to do? Or what does anybody with narcolepsy really able to do from there? While there's currently no cure for narcolepsy, treatment for symptom management does vary widely by person. But these are some of the things that they can include. So there are wake-promoting, histamine-directed, or stimulant medications that help increase alertness during the day. And then there are some nighttime medications to increase wakefulness and to help reduce cataplexy. There are antidepressant medications to help decrease the occurrence of cataplexy, and then schedule daytime naps. I can tell you that I have tried all types of these medications in different variations, in different doses, and it's kind of just an ongoing process of figuring out what is working when. It's not always going to be entirely consistent, or like you don't always just hit the gold at the very first time. You know, it's an ongoing process. But what I do know for sure in my life are that those scheduled daytime naps need to happen. They don't. My day is, I'm not going to function very well. And those episodes of brain fog are going to be more real. There are also different coping strategies, and those also vary widely by person, but some of those things can include some social support groups, which are through actual live meetups and social media or different virtual meetups that have taken place now. And then there is some improvement in general health and wellness. So through different things for sleep hygiene, diet, and fitness. I'm really bad at all of those, but I have found within this past year that the social support groups for me via Wake Up Narcolepsy have been amazing. I don't always understand some of the things that I go through or why I go through them. And I know that my friends within the sleepy community and that are on these social support groups are going through similar things, and they get it. And that's important for me. And for most, I think we all need to feel that understanding and acceptance of who we are. So my life and what it's like living with narcolepsy, while I was in that process of getting diagnosed, there was a period of time for about 4 years that I didn't work at all. And I was able to do that because I was married and then we got divorced. And at this point, when I was going through diagnosis, I had gotten remarried. So I was able to not work, and he was very much supporting us. And then during that time, I was I couldn't just stay home and do nothing. So I went back to school and I got my certification to become an educational diagnostician, which has helped me now in the long run. Now I do work from home as an educational diagnostician for K-12 online, which is a virtual school. And it has been amazing for me and my lifestyle and the fact that I do need naps sometimes during the day and things like that. So it has worked. I did say I reconciled my marriage at that point, but here now we are going through a divorce again. The first time we got divorced was for our own differences. The second time I felt like more of the issues that came about were due to a lack of support or understanding in my road to diagnosis, like, yes, he let me stay home. He let me go to the doctor and things like that, but he never went with me to the doctor. He never went with me to any of the tests that I had to take. So I always had to explain it later when I really didn't want to necessarily talk about it or didn't even remember half of what was going on. It's difficult to go from the doctor's office and they're throwing out all these new terms and medications and things, and then having to come back and spit it out at somebody else, you know? And if I didn't understand it for myself, how was I going to make somebody else understand it? And he was living with me and my husband, and, you know, it affected me in ways that I didn't really realize in the moment, but long-term it was just building. So he and I are no longer together, but he is a great support he's a great dad. So he also does realize that sometimes I am really exhausted, and he is willing to take my kids, even if it's for a few hours, if it's not, you know, his weekend or anything like that. But just our relationship didn't really work. So through all of those appointments that I think would have naturally gone to by myself, my mom was the one going with me all the time. My dad stayed home, and again, we had to explain to my dad, but there couldn't be like a whole room full of people either. So my mom was with me at the appointments, and she is amazing. And I know it hurt her as a mom, and it still hurts her now to see that I go through so many things and she can't do anything to physically help me. But her being there at all of those appointments meant the world to me. She did encourage me to speak up for myself so that doctors actually knew what was happening in my day-to-day life, which I think helped getting a diagnosis in that year and a half instead of it being even longer. And then she really, really helped serve as a recall for me as I was trying to explain to my dad or even to my siblings. Like, she knew I wasn't really going to want to talk about it, but she was able to really give them more information or tell me what I needed to do to follow up, because it was set at an appointment that I really didn't understand or remember. So yeah, she's an angel. And then I have some really amazing, understanding and supportive friends that, yes, they don't always understand what I'm actually feeling or going through, but they do understand that I'm sleepy. They do understand that there are certain things at night that still scare me, even though, like, I can tell you about it and it seems like I know that it's not real. It's very real in the moment, and they do know that. So my best friend especially will help with my kids, which in and of itself is a huge help, even if it's to watch them here at my house while I'm taking a nap, just so that they're not entirely alone watching a movie all the time, like there's somebody else with them. And she also has turned off all the lights and closed the doors for me before bed if I haven't, and that is huge. They also all understand that I'm going to take naps now, and they didn't want me to at first, and now they realize that if I don't, it's only going to make me grumpy and worse throughout the day. So that's helpful. And in all of that, I've just really learned what it is being me, and I'm still learning, but I've accepted it, that go-getter all the time, graduated at 20, was teaching and doing all these things, seemed to be losing some abilities, not necessarily losing them. I just have to do things a little bit differently every day. So now, well, about 3 years ago, we decided to homeschool our kids. And this was kind of not necessarily as a result of the diagnosis, but we knew that I wasn't always fun, exciting mom all the time, and that was hurting me. And then just different job positions that I couldn't really do because I was so tired. Just deciding to homeschool seemed right. It seemed like a right fit. And it has been. Again, we're on year three. We didn't know how far this was going to go, but we are on year three. My kids love it. It has given us more meaningful time together. Sometimes I don't wake up as early as I should, but, you know, sometimes they don't either. Kids need their sleep too. And so sometimes we start school really early. Sometimes we start school at 11. You know, it varies, but me being in this position working from home too, and just keeping it's allowed us to do all of that. So it's been the best decision that we've made. And then we have horses, and they are our babies. We go out and we feed. we ride sometimes, but if nothing else, we just spend time with them. And they have been a huge, huge support. I think even more than humans have some days. They seem to just really understand what I'm feeling without me saying anything. She gives me hugs. It seems like she wraps her neck around me. Some days she's nudging me on my back or she's right up in my face. And it's all just dependent on the mood that I'm in. All three of them, as I think anybody knows, horses can be wild sometimes, like any animal, but all three of them, as soon as my kids are there, they're calm and they've never hurt any one of us. So it's a plus. And things that I don't know, I would love to share with anybody and everybody. They are so therapeutic in so many ways. And I know that several different people with different backgrounds and disabilities feel the same. And so something that I definitely do want to share. So because of low awareness, even amongst physicians and misperceptions of what narcolepsy actually is, there is an average of 8 to 15 years between narcolepsy symptom onset and diagnosis. It's estimated that the majority of people with narcolepsy are currently undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. Some of the common misdiagnoses may include epilepsy, depression, and schizophrenia. So, like I said, when I first started seeing symptoms to actual diagnosis, it was about 9 years. So right in that average, when I actually started looking for help and getting a diagnosis, it was about 1.5 years, but I wouldn't have ever even thought that this is where it would lead. So raising awareness is extremely important to me and to my family. My kids know that mommy has narcolepsy. She's a sleepy mommy. They can recognize some of the symptoms right off the bat. Of course, they live with me. They see it more than anybody else. Just narcolepsy is so much more than sleepiness. Some of the symptoms can be memory loss, brain fog, those hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, muscle weakness, and mood swings, which throughout my story you have heard are very real in my everyday life. So I have been sharing my story today as part of our Rising Voices, which is a program of the nonprofit organization Project Sleep. This empowers patient advocates to share their stories and to improve public understanding of narcolepsy. This has been huge in my life. So thank you all for listening to my story today.
Victoria, thank you for sharing your story with everybody. Well, first of all, Victoria's wearing my favorite color today. Doesn't she look lovely, guys? I love the yellow. It's so happy and so radiates the energy that that you project, which is amazing, positive energy.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
What's it like parenting with narcolepsy? Do your kids, you know, I know you mentioned a little bit, they know you're sleepy, but, you know, how old were they maybe when they even like got a sense of it? Or, and like, what's the challenging parts and maybe what are the better parts, if there are better parts of being a parent with narcolepsy?
I think it's probably only been like 2 years, maybe. I've been diagnosed for about 4, maybe about 2 years that they really understood. And not narcolepsy as a whole, but some of my symptoms and what that is. And they know the term and they can say it. But yeah, my son, and so my daughter is 11 and my son is 9. My son is very, very compassionate in a lot of aspects. But with me, he's the first one to say like, mommy, you look like you're really tired. Maybe you should take a nap. Or we can be watching a movie and all of a sudden he'll look over, I guess, and sees me kind of dozing off. And I can hear him tell Deborah like, no, just be quiet because mom's falling asleep, or don't bother her, she's asleep. I know that there's been times where I'm kind of in and out in my room too, and they'll come into my room. And if they see me that I'm more asleep than not, I can hear them say, oh, she's asleep, we'll just ask her later. Those things hurt me as a parent, because I don't think that they should have to go through that as my own children. But at the same time, my heart just like overflows with the fact that I'm raising compassionate kids that are aware of people and their different symptoms that happen. And then also what's really cool is that neither one of them is ever ashamed to sleep for however long. I've never been one to wake them up at the crack of dawn unless we have somewhere that we really need to be. So if they can sleep all day, they'll sleep all day. Again, I homeschool, so that can be really tiring too on top of my job. Some days we don't get to do everything that I want to do or have planned. Sometimes I have things planned in my head, but I don't have all of the materials that I need. But we're able to go with the flow. So that helps. And like I said, I have a big support with my parents and with my friends and even with their dad that all help when I am really tired and just need a break. And that break is really just me sleeping. So yeah.
That's really encouraging. I think, you know, to hear about your son just sounds like, you know, already he's so empathetic, and that's just such a fantastic quality. Sometimes I think that we kind of forget also, like, you are probably more in tune with their emotions and what they're going through, and that you're promoting sleep as in a household. So Project Sleep approves of your household. Also, I was homeschooled for 2 years. I don't know if everyone knows that, just for 7th and 8th grade. And it was a great education. I learned a lot. So I'm sure that you're doing a lot and they're learning a lot. And it's ultimate nerd territory.
Yes. Yes. And that is it too. My daughter is forever. We can go anywhere and she has a book with her all the time. My mom will often say, like, they're you. Like, it's so weird. But yes, it's a definite fit for me. And then they're growing up the same way.
Someone did ask what age you got diagnosed, which is 26, right?
Yes.
But I think it was about 9 years, you said, from when your symptoms started.
Yes. And really probably more prominent, or that I started noticing them after my son was born. So
interesting. Karina would like to know, how are your cataplexy now? How's your cataplexy?
My cataplexy has never been the severe, like, and it varies. There's a severe fall on the floor kind of thing, and then just knees buckling or jaw slackening and things. One thing I didn't mention was at one point I did get diagnosed with Bell's palsy, which is like half of your face kind of loses muscle tone. But then my sleep doctor later, it only lasted for a few hours, maybe a whole day. And my sleep doctor said that it was probably really cataplexy. So all of my symptoms have been really minor. I do get knees buckling and I drop things a lot. I would probably say lately it's been about twice a week that I will have something minor happen. Again, it's nothing major, but that's varied. At some points, I don't think I felt anything for maybe like 3 months at most. Like, it was very, very sporadic. Now I'm going through a lot of stressful situations too. So I think all of that adds to it.
Matt would like to know, have you thought of incorporating equine therapy in your work with people with narcolepsy or with your students?
This is something I have thought about for a long time. It's a goal. I don't know. I don't have any definite plan right now, but yes, people with narcolepsy, my nephew has autism. People with autism benefit greatly. He loves to be out there too. And really in all aspects of life, even if it was just a day that you wanted to go out and spend with horses, like, it changes your entire mood and your day and your week. So yes, ultimately that's the goal.
Yay. Good. I can't wait to cheer you on in that. Although I'm a little bit afraid of horses, but I will still cheer you on and maybe you'll get when is the sign language version? We'll work on getting a sign language version of Victoria's story, which is going to be awesome. Iris would like to know, do you feel any effects on your memory over time?
I definitely feel like short-term memory. I forget a lot of things that maybe I either said or didn't say to people, those kinds of things. So then they're just not in my memory at all long-term. I think that's been the biggest thing. And I have noticed it is definitely more when I'm in a emotionally stressed or high stress on top. It just makes me more tired. And then that affects my memory even worse.
Okay. Iris has another question. She says, it really seems like you've taken such control over various aspects of your life, which I rarely see people taking. Do you feel this has been the best decision to help your day-to-day life with narcolepsy?
The decision to homeschool, work from home, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So like I said, I wasn't working for 4 years and it was really, really just to find a diagnosis and something to get me functioning fully again. And then when I did, yeah, that's right about when we started to decide to homeschool. And then this is just my second year working online from home. But yes, they've definitely changed how I can do things. In the classroom, in a brick and mortar school, I couldn't just take a nap all the time. Yes, we have conference periods, but they often were filled with planning and professional development and things like that just don't allow even for a nap. And then for me, my naps, this varies. Some people can take a nap for like 20 minutes and be okay. And some people need a 2-hour nap and be okay. And mine are more about an hour to 2 hours, which wasn't going to happen in the school setting. And it is what I have a passion for. So it is what I wanted to do. So being able to do that with my own kids and then transferring it back to virtual learning, yes, has given me that flexibility and really to listen to my body also.
Something that we will always be learning and trying to do better at, right? Listening to our bodies, even when we don't really want to. Mind versus body. But it's so wonderful to hear that you do have that good situation now. I feel similarly. And I feel, you know, very fortunate not only to have my dream job running this organization, but just the flexibility of being at home has made a huge difference, I think, for me. So let's see. We did have a great question from Anton. Was wondering about not having, you know, spousal support either. Like, what has been most helpful for you as far as social support?
I think it's varied at different times in my life. Sometimes I do find like I retreat and am by myself a lot, and it just helps me deal or not deal. I have to say that too. Sometimes I just want to sleep and not deal with anything. But I am really close to my parents. They don't live far from me at all. And I'm with them a lot. And even there, it's not necessarily that I talk about it or I talk about anything. Sometimes I'm just there to sleep. But I know I have peace knowing that my kids are being taken care of and that there's at least people around. I don't want to be entirely alone. Here in this past year that I've been on the Wake Up Narcolepsy support groups on Wednesdays and Saturdays, sometimes I am able to do that. Sometimes I am able to do just one day. Here it's been like 2 weeks that I haven't been able to do either one. But they've been a huge help because it's all varying walks of life. They understand the symptoms may not be entirely the same, but they understand the level of sleepiness. They understand that you're not going to function to your full potential every day. So that support group has been huge, huge for me. And it's other adults because I homeschool and I need adults.
Yeah. I think like people always, the word support group, it turned me off, you know, when I was first diagnosed, I was like, oh, I don't need a support group, but I don't know. There's something with the word. And I like to like remind people it's like information sharing, you know, it's just like the best way. I like to say that I can credit some support groups I attended with some of the best decisions I've ever made, or like my understanding of the side effects of treatments and the word anxiety. Like I didn't know what anxiety was. It was hearing someone else talk about it and describe their anxiety. And I was like, oh my God, I've been experiencing that for years. And I had no idea that's what that word meant. So yeah, can't, you know, speak highly enough about a support group than you've just said.
I think that, is more like, especially if you come from a family like mine, they're amazing, but they're also very much we're go-getters. All of us when I say that I'm close to my family and we're always together, they're always having a get-together. And for a while, I felt so bad, like I wasn't actively participating in their get-together. So those kinds of things kind of come into play also. But they're learning right along with me now, and I'm grateful for that. And then, like I said, everybody in that support group has felt that at one moment or another. And we can just share that experience. It's so helpful. And then there's some of my best friends now. There's some of the people that I text first when something's going to happen. They're all I know cheering me on because we've had this group chat about today for a while. So it's really nice.
All right. So Lizzie, hi, Lizzie. Lizzie would like to know, she also loves horses. It's a little bit in her presentation as well. And so she says that she loves horses, equine assisted therapy. And just curious if you could speak to how your horse experience has helped you to learn about your own emotional regulation or presence.
So I think I talked to Julie a little bit about this. Like some days it's just walking in with my horses and they just know, like their senses are heightened. And if I have been really emotional. My horse is normally, that's normally the day that she's kind of trying to hug me or nudge me a lot. And so that's kind of helped me be more aware of when I need to go also, because then that support helps me get through my day or those emotions. While I'm out there, I haven't had a cataplexy attack at all, which is huge because, I mean, I'm excited to be with them. I'm happy to be with them. There's always something happening. But I've never had a cataplexy attack out there. And like, I can be awake for hours without ever even thinking about a nap while I'm out there. I can remember one time really looking back and thinking that because we had been with our horses riding them, and then we bathed them. And then we went to go see a roping that lasted until 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was out there all day. And I looked back and I was like, man, I didn't take a nap today. And I didn't feel the need to take a nap that day. So I don't know that it's necessarily helped me identify a lot of feelings, but I do know that they are very much in tune with how I'm feeling.
That is a great point. Kimberly would like to know, how do you feel about driving? Do you, thinking about the distance or the time in driving a car?
Yeah, this is something that's come up recently for me too. I used to drive prior to symptoms, I guess, a lot. I mean, I've made a 10-hour drive by myself with nobody in the car before. Lately, one, I don't know if it's that I am at home a lot. So then when I do have to drive, it's a challenge. If I'm within my own town or even the town over, it's normally about 15 to 20 minutes. I'm okay. 45-minute drive is going to be really difficult for me. And it has started to scare me sometimes. I guess I feel like I've gotten there and successfully, but gone autopilot. I don't remember how I got there or anything like that. So that just feeling that uncertainty has led me to not drive as much if it's a long drive. And normally if it's a long drive, I have somebody with me anyway. It's my mom or my friend, so I just make them drive instead. And they become my chauffeur for things. But yeah, that comfort level is different for everybody. It doesn't affect everybody. So really, if you're feeling bad, I just wouldn't drive. And that's where I'm at with it. If I feel tired, I'm not going to really drive anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. I know when I lived in Washington, D.C., and I was still not sure, I just made a 40-minute limit. And so I just tell my friends, if it was over 40 minutes, they had to drive. And some days I was fine to drive longer than 40 minutes, but it was kind of just having that rule set in advance that made it less awkward. It was just kind of known, than that, oh, okay, so I have to drive if it's longer. And it set a boundary, and made situations a little bit less awkward, as opposed to me every single time being like, well, geez, it's an hour, it might be tough for me. And then I expanded it out. I think it's just naturally at your own comfort, as Victoria beautifully said. So, all right. Well, I think that we don't have any other major questions right now. Thank you again to Victoria on sharing your story tonight. All right. Bye for now.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.